Good afternoon, everybody. Shmuel Plasser coming at you live. It's book club time, and we're studying reading Wisdom from the House of Healing, Transformative Encounters of a Hospital Chaplain by Rabbi Hanan Balch, Rabbi Emeritus of Gulf Meadows Synagogue. Welcome aboard. Problem was, last week we did a half hour of material, and it didn't capture on the audio tape, so I'm afraid what I'm going to have to do right now is do a little bit of review. And so those of you who were with us last week, this might be a little bit boring, or you could just call it chazar, you can call it a bit of review. But for the sake of sheerenjoyment.com, for the sake of the platform, I figured now that the machine is working better, we're going to do the whole chapter two all in one fell swoop right now, and we'll do the entire chapter two. So that means kind of going back to the beginning of last week and reviewing what we read and then moving forward. So the first few minutes, you may have heard already. Hopefully you enjoy them. Don't hang up and call back in a half hour. Stay in. We'll move quickly through the material, and with God's help, we'll do the entire chapter two together today. Chapter two, A House of Healing. Meditation upon entering the hospital. How awe-inspiring is this place? This is surely a house of God and the gateway to the heavens. Genesis 28. That's what Yaakov Avinu said when he woke up from his dream and he was at the Beis HaMikdash area on Har HaBayit. Rabbi Balch is taking that phraseology and applying it to a hospital. Reimagining a hospital. The word hospital, which is utilized in the English language, indicates it was once a place of gathering for strangers or guests who were hosted and offered hospitality as they traveled upon their journey from one place to the next. And indeed, as we said last week, that's very likely what was going on during the medieval period when the pilgrims would go from one pilgrimage site to another. And you see captured in the Canterbury Tales where they're going from one place to the next in order to get to the cathedral, I think in Canterbury. And so they stay over in this place and that place. And today we'd call it a hostel. You know, a youth hostel, a place, you find that in Israel, you stay over in Jerusalem for 20 bucks a night, you get to stay in a youth hostel. There's not much going on over there except for a toilet and a shower. You want to eat, you're on your own. But there is a bed, and there is a bathroom, and for basic human functions, that's all you're going to get for 20 bucks, but it's not bad when you need it. So it all events, the word hospitality, if you will, in English, spawned the idea of the word hospital, where you get treatment. Says Rabbi Balch, it had nothing to do with its contemporary context of a place sought out by those who are sick to a degree that they cannot mend at home on their own. That's why people go to hospitals today. They can't heal themselves up. You need surgery. You're not doing that by yourself. You need a blood transfusion. You don't have any blood in your apartment. So you're going to have to go to the hospital for that kind of treatment. However, the word hospital that we know today had nothing at all to do with 1,000 years ago where hospitality was given from the host to a guest, given some food, drink, a place to stay. It had nothing to do with healing up sick people. It was just giving chesed, giving food and a place to lodge for those who were traveling. In the Hebrew language, a language which was largely unspoken for almost 2,000 years, as the Jewish people wandered the earth in exile from their national homeland, no such term existed for a hospital until the 20th century, when they began to anticipate a return to that land. The term Bet Cholim, a house of the sick, was chosen to describe the modern hospital, which is why today you go to Israel and you talk about in terms of Bet Cholim Hadassah, Hadassah Hospital, Bet Cholim, oh goodness, in Israel, in Tel Aviv you have one, in Bnei Brak you have one, and you have one in maybe Ramat Gan or Ra'anana or Petah Tikva, wherever you've got. The Klausenberger Rebbe was involved in a hospital. And so you have hospitals dotted throughout the country in Israel, but they're all called Batei Cholim, houses of the sick. The Lubavitcher Rebbe was not into that. One of the leading rabbis of the 20th century and a person who lived a life that saw all existence in a positive light that was moving toward redemption, Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson, also known as the Rebbe of Lubavitch, he objected to this contemporary Hebrew term, Bet Cholim, house of the sick, and instead insisted the word for hospital be rendered bet refuah, a house of healing. He believed this terminology was both more encouraging to the patients and more authentically reflected the goal and the major activity of the institution, bet refuah, a house of healing. As a congregational rabbi, a house of the sick, bet cholim, would have accurately reflected my experience as I visited congregants in the hospital. That's why I had gone there, and the sick is who I had seen. That all changed when I began to work regularly in that environment, even immersing myself in its culture as a chaplain. I now fully embrace that place as a Beit Refuah, a house of healing. Indeed, aside from the meaningful reasons suggested, it also accurately describes the responsibilities of the chaplain, who serves not only the sick, but the families of the sick, the medical staff, and even fellow chaplains. Moreover, the greatest healing that transpired in my efforts to bring spiritual healing to others may have been the spiritual healing that affected me. Sacred space. When I walk into the hospital each day, I reflect upon Jacob's statement following his magnificent dream of a ladder with angels ascending and descending its rungs. How awe-inspiring is this place? Manara makom hazeh. This is surely a house of God and a gateway to the heavens. Kiyam beis elokim v'zeh shar hashamayim. This is surely a house of God and a gateway to the heavens. Genesis 28. Of course, I am reflecting as one who is not sick and not going through the emotional turmoil of the patient. I imagine most people consider a hospital to be a frightening place. It is a place, after all, where one normatively encounters pain and suffering, tragedy and death, with perhaps the one exception of the unparalleled joy of parents welcoming a new child into the world. Many have experienced traumatic episodes in the hospital, be it the death of loved ones or their own brush with mortality, episodes that may never leave them. How then could one possibly imagine that he could encounter God in such a place? The answer to this question requires us to understand how Jacob could appreciate the unique spiritual character of the place where he found himself. Even amidst great fear and loneliness, as he fled from his brother Esav, who sought to kill him. Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik explains, quote, God's revelation at times of crisis, from the depths of despair and distress, is a basic principle of Judaism. Sometimes God does not reveal himself to the contented soul. He reveals himself to the mute soul, battered by weariness and exertion. Sometimes he does not reveal himself to the rational individual, but to the one who is confused about life, bankrupt, and lost track of his world. From time to time, man's salvation comes out of distress. And there, Rabbi Balk gives us the footnote. It comes from Rabbi Soloveitchik's book, Umisham Tivakesh, if I'm not mistaken, and from there you shall seek. Page 33, the tone, drama, and power of these words are to be found in parallel descriptions of the experience of God throughout Rabbi Soloveitchik's writings. Interestingly, Rabbi Soloveitchik himself stated with regard to his own experience within the hospital, and here he's writing in Tradition magazine in an article called Majesty and Humility, quote, 11 years ago, my wife lay on her deathbed, and I watched her dying, day by day, hour by hour. Medically, I could do very little for her. All I could do was to pray. However, I could not pray in the hospital. Somehow, I could not find God in the whitewashed, long corridors among the interns and the nurses. The moment I returned home, I would rush to my room, fall on my knees, and pray fervently. Suffice it to say, my own experience has been nothing of the sort. I have found the possibility for divine encounter and prayer in a hospital to be almost ubiquitous. Ubiquitous is a word, beautiful word, meaning to be found everywhere. says Rabbi Balk, so too I have come to believe that the hospital, notwithstanding its harsh realities, is just as authentically a place of holiness, inspiration, hope, and renewal as it is of dread and resignation. Truth be told, this was already recognized by the Jewish faith long ago. For when one is ill, the Talmud teaches that the divine presence, thank you, the Shekhinah, is with the patient, specifically at that time, when he is most vulnerable, when he may be unable to muster the spiritual or physical strength to support himself. What a comforting thought, that in the midst of a person suffering, not only has God not abandoned him, as one may be led to conclude at difficult times, God is there with him in abundance. This would make the accessibility of God in a hospital far greater than almost any other place we know. Even a house of worship generally provides prayer rituals and services at particular times in the day. A hospital, however, is never closed or devoid of its flock, no matter what the time. The individual hospital room should thereby be seen, I believe, as sacred space. When one enters the room, he encounters not only the patient, but the presence of God himself, who is with the patient. Of course, the reason for the existence of a hospital, to promote human dignity through the saving of lives, beyond which there is no higher calling, would have been enough to establish such a premise. If we further consider the sheer amount of prayer that takes place in a hospital by patients, visitors, chaplains, even the doctors and medical staff, and if we rightfully surmise that such prayers, offered within the serious context that they are, may be some of the most fervent God will ever hear, we again can maintain that the hospital setting is uniquely aligned with not only the physical, but also the spiritual realm. It is this truth that makes the chaplain's presence all the more meaningful, with a focus upon the tremendous burdens that gnaw away at the patient's soul, aside from those that affect the body. Indeed, the traditional Hebrew prayer for healing offered publicly in the synagogue, the Mishaberach prayer, requests of God that God grant those who are sick, quote, healing of the spirit and healing of the body, end quote. One might have thought the physical concern would come first, but quite often the former, healing of the spirit, may be more urgent than the latter, exactly as the prayer has prioritized it. Page 58, and there were angels in the hospital. Additional evidence of the holiness of this place is to be found through another element of the vision that Jacob had. Of all the positive aspects of the Christ Hospital I experienced, the most impressive of them, which I had the privilege to behold every day, all day, was the nursing staff. Made up of dedicated and well-trained men and women, this team of professionals is more responsible than any other for the ongoing well-being and care of the patients during their stay in the hospital. It is no wonder. Studies I have read show nurses are seen as more trustworthy than those who occupy any other profession. I almost cannot express in words the respect I have gained. The respect I have gained for these sensitive, caring, devoted, and wonderful examples of what it means to serve others in the best way possible. My feelings about working with these outstanding individuals can only be described as euphoric. I am truly privileged I was put with such company, and I have learned a great deal from their work ethic and individualized care for their patients. Indeed, I was once visiting a Muslim patient, a woman, and I asked her how the staff was treating her. She responded in a manner I never expected. Quote, chaplain, in the Quran we read of the existence of angels. It is one of the six pillars of faith in Islam. But while I certainly believed in angels, I never had actually seen any until now. They are the nurses of the Christ Hospital. As incredible as this description is, Jewish tradition describes angels as such devoted messengers of the Creator that they can only focus on one mission at a time. Of course, the mission can be a broad one. The nurses do that as well, but they can multitask, which gives them an edge on the angels. Furthermore, the duties of angels, as presented in the Bible, would be called today a one and done. An angel stops Abraham from sacrificing his son. An angel provides salvation to Hagar and her son Ishmael in the desert. An angel battles with Jacob. Each of these well-known cases presents an angel who carries out his task at the appropriate time and is then finished. As for the nurses, there is no completion of the task because there is always another with which to engage. Their devotion is total, uncompromising, and yes, continuous. As far as the level of care, I can attest that they are committed to caring for every patient as if that patient was their own mother or father. I have retold the comments of the Muslim patient to many members of the nursing staff, especially when they were having a hard day. Hard days are common if you know the nurses generally work 12-hour shifts, barely have time for lunch or dinner, and can have their share of difficult patients. Patients who may use them as punching bags to unburden themselves of the frustrations often legitimately overwhelming them. Amidst an unexpected visit to a place they have no desire to be, in their humility, the nursing staff does not generally feel comfortable with the characterization of being angels. Several even remarked to me, "Chaplain, listen, if we are angels, and it truly warms our hearts for someone to describe us in such a manner, we need to come clean about something. That is only true while we work here in the hospital. But you should know outside of the hospital, we are no angels." Fair enough. I only claim the hospital to be a place of holiness, not everywhere else beyond its walls. Angels without wings. While we are on the subject of angels, it is not uncommon for patients to see me as some type of angel, a status from which I am further than anyone. A person had arrived in the emergency room, and I paid him a visit and offered to pray for him. He looked at me as if in shock and then asked, "Are you a rabbi?" "Yes, I am." "Dear God, I have serious ongoing problems with my heart and my kidneys, and in the ambulance on the way to the hospital, I decided this is my final fight to live. I'm not doing this anymore. I give up. I told God if he wants me to fight on with all I have gone through, he'll have to send an angel to convince me. And then you, a rabbi, walk into the room to pray for me at the Christ Hospital. That confirms that God has heard my prayer. I will continue to fight. Please pray for me, Rabbi. Please pray for me." Another time, I happened upon a patient and her friend who told me upon my arrival that they had prayed for an angel to come to inspire the patient not to be overwhelmed with thoughts of suicide, which is why she came to the emergency room that day. I asked them, "Come on, really? You just prayed for an angel to come, and then immediately I walked into the room?" "Well, to be honest, it did take about 10 minutes for you to get here after we completed our prayer. So I guess it was not exactly immediately." "Okay," now defending my angelic status. "First of all, you know angels are not just sitting around and doing nothing. It can sometimes take a little while, 10 minutes or so, for them to get from one mission to another. Second, if I am an angel, I'm a very low-level angel. I've yet to get my wings and sharpen all of my angelic skills. So unlike the movie, It's a Wonderful Life, Rabbi Balk has not yet gotten his wings. Now, lest anyone believe this is going to my head, consider the following story. A famous rabbi in Jerusalem was believed by his followers to possess the Ruach HaKodesh, the Holy Spirit, supernatural insight about events. In this case, that a woman was pregnant. When asked, as he often was, in similar situations, how he knew such things, he would explain, "You see, I can openly admit that the Holy Spirit dwells within me, because it dwells within all of us. For King David petitioned God in the Psalms, 'Do not cast me away from your presence.'" Al tashdecheni milfanecha. "Do not cast me," okay, so if it's me, then al tashlicheni milafanecha, don't cast me away from before you. Ruach katshecha, and your Holy Spirit, al tikach mimeni, don't take away from me. That is Psalm 51, verse 13. This verse is said by all of the Jewish people in preparation for and on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. Obviously, we could not ask God not to take the Holy Spirit from us unless we all possessed it. What a fascinating thought. I never thought that I was the possessor of Ruach HaKodesh. You guys know that? That I've got it? And did you know that you've got it? I'm going to tell everybody I know that I've got it. Ruach Katzecha, Tikach Mimeni. But maybe only King David could say that. Who knows? But you know, then again, we all, as Rabbi Balk said, we all pray that. We all say that verse again and again during the Aseret Tshuva and on Yom Kippur. So of course we have it. Similarly, to some degree, we are all angels. I am no more suited for that appellation than anyone else. For what is an angel but a messenger from God who arrives, often unexpectedly, at just the right moment to intervene or to convey a vital message to a person in need of assistance? Footnote, from this perspective, how poignant is the statement of the medieval sage Ibn Ezra in the introduction to his commentary on the Torah. Quote, the angel that mediates between man and God is one's mind. Maimonides also speaks of an angel who conveys the message of prophecy within and as a part of the mind. See Moreh Nevuchim, the guy for the perplexed, by Maimonides. And see Moshe Halbertal's book, Maimonides, Life and Thought. And that's where we got to last week. Now fresh material, page 64. The doctors, those who have devoted themselves to healing others, are surely engaged in the most respected profession that can be imagined. Simply put, doctors save lives. There is no greater act of loving kindness than to restore a person's life, a person's health, back to him. Physical well-being, while not necessarily a necessity for spiritual well-being, certainly allows the latter, spiritual well-being, to be fully expressed and focused upon without the distraction of illness and weakness. Doctors are, from the religious perspective, instruments of God, the means by which God alleviates pain and suffering. What a tremendous role to play in his world. Suffice it to say, the many doctors with whom I have had encounters at the Christ Hospital practice their art with humility, sensitivity, and tremendous integrity. As men and women of science, they have also shown me tremendous respect, understanding the role that faith plays in the lives of their patients, even as they themselves may or may not personally engage in that faith. In a shocking statement that has generated at least 14 attempted explanations, the Talmud declares the best of doctors destined for hell.
I know this one.
You do?
Yeah.
You have a shot?
Yes.
Let's hear it. I'm wrong.
All of the doctors have to go up to Gehenna so that they could heal all the people in Gehenna.
Wow. That's beautiful. Tov Shibaroth from the Gehenna. The good doctors among doctors, they go to hell. And they're going to hell, you're saying, in order to do good over there, in order to heal people. That's beautiful. They're not going to hell because they deserve hell. No. That's less trap. So says Rabbi Balk, there are at least 14 attempted explanations. The Talmud declares! What does the Talmud declare? The best of doctors are destined for hell. Gemara Kedushin 82a. This statement has been met with great consternation. If, as we have previously mentioned, a doctor is involved in saving human life, then who should be more precious to God than a doctor? The great scholar Maimonides was also a doctor, as were other great Jewish religious leaders. Moreover, the notion is comically baffling within a culture that presents Jewish parents as those who would love to have their children become doctors, and the children are happy to oblige. Indeed, the prominence of Jewish doctors is such that many times when I enter a patient's room, donning my yarmulke on my head, he will greet me with, "Hello, doctor." If he is on the phone, he will tell the listening party he needs to hang up because a doctor just walked in. I am just as likely to be judged to be a doctor as a rabbi chaplain. And of course, this is the place for me to tell one of my favorite jokes. It talks so much about Jewish culture. About the Jewish man who was elected president of the United States. Finally, a Jewish man has his turn. And so he calls his mother and tells her to please come to the inauguration, which will take place a few months from then, in January, in Washington, D.C. And so she shows up on a very, very cold day, and she's watching her son as he stands on the podium, raises his right hand, puts his left hand in the Bible, is about to take the oath of office, and the mother gives a hard elbow to a total stranger in his solar plexus and screams, "You see that boy up there? His brother's a doctor." I got to say, there's no funnier joke on the earth. I mean, that is like the funniest joke I've ever heard in my life. I mean, it's so American Jewish. You got to appreciate American Jewish culture. I don't want to belabor the point, but I hope you laughed. You see that brother up there taking the oath of office to be the most powerful person on the face of the earth, in charge of the most powerful country? His brother is a doctor. What could possibly put it into clear perspective than that? The multiple interpretations that follow are typical of Jewish study, which attempts to understand tradition from numerous vantage points and derive as many valuable lessons as possible. Such engagement is part of the very fiber of the Jewish moral and intellectual dynamic. I always thought, in a more humorous approach, that the statement, "the best doctors go to hell," that the statement is entirely true and should be understood in the reverse of what it seems to say. And after all, there is no need for the Talmud to inform us the best doctors are destined for heaven, for all is fine and everyone is living well. What will they do there? The place that requires the best doctors is hell, right? Where everyone is suffering and anguish, and where only the best doctors might be able to bring about some healing. It is, in this context, a statement of praise. But other views see it differently. Some merely understand the statement as a warning to the doctor to always be aware that his profession often has life and death in the balance of his decisions. One small mistake could lead to the demise of the patient and consequently of the doctor as well. Another view suggests that if a doctor sees himself as, quote, the best of doctors, so that he has no need to consult with other colleagues or to acquire new knowledge to stay up to date with the constantly evolving medical field, even in ancient times, and all the more so today, then he surely will be deserving of a life in the underworld. Finally, some take an alternative perspective. The best doctors who truly care for their patients and are constantly worrying about them are destined for a life of hell in this world due to the heavy burden that they bear in taking upon themselves the suffering of so many. This view thereby understands the statement to be a further expression of praise for these devoted individuals who are so obsessed with and devoted to the welfare of their patients that their concern never wavers and their worry never ceases. This is a tremendous undertaking indeed. Page 67, miracles. If one believes in the veracity of the Bible, he believes in miracles. How they occur remains a mystery even for the believer. If one has actually been involved in the occurrence of a miracle, I imagine he may also be a staunch believer. For many years, I taught community adult education classes about Judaism. One lesson discussed childbirth and the issues that surround it. After that lesson, a young couple approached me and explained that the discussion of this topic had been especially painful for them. For years, they had wished for a precious child to hold in their arms, as most of their friends had experienced with no hardship. With tears, frustration, and some anger, they told me they were doing everything medically possible to allow for a breakthrough, but their doctors were not optimistic. One specialist bluntly told them, "If you are planning on having a large family, don't. because it's not going to happen. They were devastated and asked me if, from a spiritual perspective, there was anything else that they could do. I explained to them that the Talmud relates that there are three keys that God does not hand over to any agent: the key to rain, the key to childbirth, and the key to the resurrection of the dead. And sure enough, we're going to see that very shortly in Gemara Tainus. It says here 2a. It might be 2a or 2b. But 2b or not 2b, this discussion is also echoed in 1 Kings, where Elijah the prophet, if I'm not mistaken, it's in 1 Kings, where Elijah the prophet has the key to rain, and then he asks for the key to the resurrection of the dead. God says to him, wait a second. There are only three keys to begin with. I lent you one. I have two. Now you have one. I have two. You're asking for the second one? How many am I going to be left with? Well, there's only three going around. You're going to have two. I'm going to have only one. Me? God? I'll have only one, and you're going to have two? It doesn't work quite like that. You're going to have to give me back one if you want one, another one. So I just said, okay. So I'll give you back the key to rain. And God kept the key to rain, or in the opposite. But it was not the case that Elijah was allowed to have two. There was a point where he was resurrecting children. There was a point where he was holding back the rain from the Jewish people in order to get them to repent. But he was not allowed to maintain both keys simultaneously, if I'm not mistaken. So look up the Talmud, Tanis 2a or 2b, and look up Elijah in the end of 1 Kings, beginning of 2 Kings. Says Rabbi Balk, all three of these keys are examples of life-bestowing events that only the source of all life can bring about, meaning the Almighty God. I suggested, therefore, that it would be helpful at this juncture to introduce God into the picture. I asked if they begin to pray each day, something they had never done before, and if they pray for others as well as for themselves. They also took their Hebrew names and began to pray fervently for them. Slowly, various observances were studied and then practiced, including the Jewish family purity laws that govern the relationship between husband and wife. These laws require the physical separation of the couple from the onset of her period, during which they must relate to each other in a manner that emphasizes the other aspects of love beyond a physical relationship. This period of separation concludes with the woman immersing in a gathering of mikveh waters, whereupon they may once again engage. In observance of these laws, the young woman shared with me that as she immersed herself into these waters and prayed to God to give her a child, her tears actually flowed down her face into the water. Many months went by without results. And then, one day, through what the couple and I believed could only have been a miracle, she conceived. This couple now has four beautiful children. That doctor, renowned in his field as he might have been, did not hold that key. A similar story occurred when a couple in a different class, where we had also studied the three keys notion, decided that they wanted to convert to Orthodox Judaism as quickly as possible. A little background about this couple would probably be of interest. The husband was from Iraq, and the wife was from Lebanon. You read that correctly. Why, I asked them, would you want to convert to Judaism? They explained that a doctor had told them that they would never have children, which distressed them greatly. In this case, however, the husband was told that if he had a certain procedure, there was a chance that their fate could be different. The husband had the surgery. Then, one day, he came running into my classroom in a highly emotional state. He proceeded to tell me his wife was pregnant. Fantastic, I replied. It looks like the surgery you had worked. But then he explained, quote, but that is just it, Rabbi. The doctor determined in calculating the due date that without a doubt, my wife became pregnant before I had the surgery, when he said it was impossible. So it is just like you said about childbirth in class. There are three keys God does not hand over to anyone else, and this is one of them. The doctor said it couldn't happen, but it did. Since this couple had not been devoted to the religious backgrounds of their parents, they did not have to go through the difficult task of rejecting their previous faith to enter a new one. They converted to Orthodox Judaism and now have two daughters. Of course, the doctors in the above cases were presenting the diagnosis based on their expert medical experience. Still, Jewish tradition warns against the possibility of becoming overly confident when one has such great expertise regarding the health and future outcomes of others, including what may even be scenarios of life and death. Once, I went to visit a middle-aged Jewish patient recovering from exploratory surgery. Her doctor had informed her just days before her son's wedding that cancer had spread throughout her body and the prognosis was not good. But when I visited her after the surgery, she shared news that put me in disbelief. When the doctor opened her up, there was nothing there. No sign of cancer whatsoever. Of course, we immediately prayed and thanked God for this miracle. Later that day, I approached the doctor. Tell me, doctor, you said the cancer was everywhere. Then you looked, and there was nothing there. Nothing. What do you call that, doctor? A miracle? In my entire career, which has spanned many decades, I have never seen something like this before. In the language of religion, I guess you would call it a miracle, because I have no other explanation that makes any sense. This is a tough book to get through for me. When I spoke of this occurrence to a friend who was a doctor in the same field, he responded, Rabbi, this case neither proves nor disproves the notion of miracles. I can also find no cancer in a patient if the cancer was never there in the first place. The explanation is that the doctor must not have initially taken a biopsy to be absolutely sure the tissue was cancerous. Many months later, the patient confirmed that the doctor had not taken a biopsy, but she added, nevertheless, if this doctor had observed my condition so many times in others and knew from experience that a tragic outcome was likely the result, then that itself is the miracle for which I am forever grateful. And so, there are those who don't believe in miracles, and those who consider them from different perspectives. How does one know the difference? That is a difficult matter that continues to foster debate. And I did not know. Indeed, God is in this place, and I did not know, said Jacob, Genesis 28. Vanochi lo yadati. In these words, Jacob acknowledges something remarkable. God is not only to be found in the religious sanctuaries constructed to be utilized for the praise of his name. God can appear at any time, in any place, and within any context, as God did as Jacob was fleeing from his brother who sought to kill him. A famous vignette from Jewish folklore tells that a rabbi was once asked, where is God to be found? To which he cleverly responded, in typical Jewish fashion, with another question. You tell me, where is he not to be found? Alternatively, and of greater importance for our purposes, was a second answer. God is to be found wherever people allow him to enter. Kutzker, the Kutzker River. Like the roller coaster of life itself, the patient encounters that I will describe herein are humorous and tearful, tender and shocking, joyous and tragic. Page 73. We conclude chapter 2 with this page. All stories reveal lessons that can inspire. If one chooses to invite God into the conversation or listens soulfully to their messages, sometimes simple, sometimes profound, but almost always unexpected. For if there is one truth I have accepted in my own spiritual life, it is that one may run into God and bump into moments of spiritual grandeur without preparation or expectation for such discovery, within everyday mundane experiences, not necessarily amidst the spiritual environment we seek to create or the sacred ritual in which we engage to foster such occurrences. To embrace those unexpected, God-infused moments is to let the healing begin. Wow. One may run into God and bump into moments of spiritual grandeur without any preparation or expectation for that discovery. Think in your life if that's ever happened to you. I feel I've had an experience like that when I was a kid, almost drowned as a child, and years later when I pondered it, I had a revelation, seems to me, some sort of epiphany, that I really have to dedicate myself towards doing something that would properly, how do I say this? What's the word I'm looking for? That would allow for me to stand in front of God on the day of my judgment and say, sure, glad you let me live because I went on to do some good stuff. I hope I was a blessing to some people. Otherwise, I would have been a statistic like they have in the Catskills. Sadly, there's always an accident. Somebody always breaks a bone in the summertime. And some little children, never, they don't make it out of the summer. They get caught in a whirlpool in a pool and they can't get out of it. Or they fall into a river and they weren't properly always put together with their life preserver or whatever it may be. There are stories like that that are consistently sad and you come across them virtually every summer. And I could have been one of them. And I'm so grateful that the Almighty saved my life. So I could stand before him one day and say, so glad that you gave me extra years. If you had taken me at 10, what would have happened to this person and that person? How would I have helped this person? I'm so glad you enabled me, that you allowed me to live and didn't let me drown. Another couple of seconds, I wouldn't have made it out. And I just would have been another little child who didn't make it out of the summertime. So I want to thank the Almighty publicly, right here, right now, for coming into my life in such a clear way, shaking me up and making me realize that I'm always on borrowed time, that every day is a real blessing. I have to just do the best I can each and every day for my wife, for my children, for my community, for the Almighty, for my mother, my siblings and their families. Do whatever I can to make the world a much, much better place, because that's why I'm here after all. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here. I think that Donald Trump at the same moment when he realized, I mean, yeah, you could be 78, you could be 30, you could be 90, but he had a moment of mortality hitting him like nothing else had. He moved his head in such a way that a bullet grazed his ear and hit his ear. I mean, you can't miss any closer than that. And he said, I shouldn't even be here today. I'm not supposed to be here with you today, because he was supposed to get killed that day. Donald Trump could have no longer been on the earth. There was a 20-year-old who wanted to take him out, and he came this close. It's amazing when you realize how precious life is. Im kol zeh, with all the difficulties and all the sadness that can come into a life, still in all, it's a beautiful thing. And it's given to us by the Almighty to celebrate, to be joyous, to help one another, to be a blessing in each other's lives, to love each other consistently and profoundly. Whether we're spouses, whether we're children to parents or children to each other, the goal, and yes, the challenge, is to love each other immensely and without any stint, without any deficiency in that love. It's got to be a profound love of generosity, of giving, of devotion, and generosity of spirit that will make the world a better place. Olam chesed yibana, says the psalmist. The Almighty created a world of kindness. Let's be agents of that kindness. Certainly doctors and nurses are. And I'm grateful to those nurses who helped my father live as long as he did. And my mother, she should live and be well. She's been in and out of hospitals many, many times over the past several years and in rehab. And consistently, the doctors and nurses have been there to help her heal up and make her feel better. May the Almighty continue to give her good health as we go forward into the future. I wish all of you, my dear listeners, good health in the schus of our reading of these wonderful stories. May the Almighty have mercy on us and give us briut, gesund, good health as well. And may he give me strength to be able to get through this book without too many tears, because it hits hard. Wishing everybody a good day. And with God's help, we'll see you tomorrow night for Tanakh Tuesday as we conclude Chapter 1 of the book of Isaiah. I look forward to seeing you there, 7:30, in Gulf Meadow Synagogue Live, or you can call in. Wishing everybody a great day. Shmuel Pofker coming at you live, thanking you for your time. Thank you, Jake and Mitch, for all you do for our Gulf Meadow Synagogue School of Jewish Studies. Thank you, Jake and Mitch, of SheerEnjoyment.com. Everybody have a great rest of the day, and we'll see you tomorrow night at 7:30. Take care and be well. Bye-bye now.